You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for March 16th Saturday reading of the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Aurora firefighters were rescuing rescuers early Friday and enlightening snow day revelers by Christine O., Sentinel, Colorado. Fatal shooting early Friday leads to police chase in Aurora, snowy crash, and arrests by the Sentinel. Aircraft noise and leaded fuel are the targets of a proposed bill winding its way through the legislature by Monty Whaley. Inglewood accepting applications to fix up neighborhoods by Elizabeth Slay. Littleton envisions Quad Road on South Santa Fe Drive and West Mineral Avenue by Nina Joss. For Arapahoe County snow crew, big March storm arrived well before the first flake fell by Deborah Grigsby. And various stories and articles. Aurora firefighters were rescuing rescuers early Friday and enlightening snow day revelers. Amidst the heavy and deep snow clobbering Aurora and the Front Range, a fake ambulance had to make an urgent non-emergency run after midnight last night near South Buckley Road and East Kenyon Drive in South Aurora. The ambulance got stuck in the snow, so ambulance drivers called for a backup ambulance to come and get the patient in non-critical condition, fire department officials said in a statement. The second ambulance got stuck in the snow. At about 2 a.m., an Aurora Fire and Rescue crew arrived and pulled the ambulance out of the snow. It took less than 15 minutes, according to officials. Firefighters arrived in a Brush 13 Type 3 4x4 wildland engine. It is typically used for wildland fires but has been upstaffed during the snowstorm to assist standard motorists and emergency vehicles that become stuck in the snow, officials said. The freed ambulance was about to transport the patient to the hospital. Our team is proud to serve our community in any circumstance, AFR Fire Chief Alec Otten said in a statement. Using our resources to pivot from fires to snowstorms speaks volumes about the skills of our firefighters. We are dedicated to doing whatever it takes to provide exceptional care, protection, and support for our community. Coming back from a call earlier in the evening, firefighters shed a little light on some neighborhood fun among teenagers taking full advantage of a school snow day. A handful of high school students were out at about 9 p.m. in the snow making turns and jumps with snowboards and skis on a hill near Cherokee Ridge High School in southeast Aurora. The students had created some jumps in the snow, and our crew provided some lighting on the snow hill for them for a short while, Fire Department spokesperson Don Small said. Fatal shooting early Friday leads to police chase in Aurora, snowy crash, and arrests. Two people were shot, one fatally, early Friday during a shooting in North Central Aurora that turned into a police chase along snowy streets into Denver. Police responded to reports of a shooting at about 3 a.m. somewhere along the 14600 block of East 2nd Avenue. One woman died from her gunfire injuries, and another person was wounded by gunshots, police said. Three suspects sped away from the scene in a moving truck and were pursued by patrol officers until the truck became stuck in the snow near E-470 and Pena Boulevard in Denver. Aurora Police spokesperson Joy Moylan said in a statement, "The suspects tried to run. All three were quickly taken into custody. One of the suspects was also shot at some point, but the suspect was not shot by police," Moylan said. Details about the suspects was not released. Both shooting victims were taken to a hospital. The unidentified woman died there from her gunshot injuries. The other person is being treated. Police said anyone with information can call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. Tipsters can remain anonymous and still be eligible for a reward of up to $2,000, police said. Aurora lawmakers hesitant to smoke excise tax on marijuana producers. By Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Aurora City Council demurred Monday on a proposal to eliminate the city's 5% excise tax on marijuana growing operations, questioning its necessity and how the city would make up for the lost revenue. Council member Curtis Gardner, who sponsored the proposed tax cut along with council member Danielle Jurinski, has expressed interest in sponsoring a tax cut benefiting wholesale marijuana businesses since September. That's when city staffers told the council about the disappearance of local marijuana cultivation operations in the city and how pot sales had fallen since the pandemic, which a lobbyist blamed in part on high taxes. Eliminating the excise tax that voters approved in 2014 would save the city's 13 remaining growers about $686,000 every year, money that would otherwise go into a special marijuana fund that has benefited projects including recreation centers and transportation work. I think eliminating our excise tax rate has the potential to incentivize these businesses to relocate into Aurora, Gardner said, adding that lower taxes could also lower the price of marijuana for consumers. If we are able to reduce this excise tax or eliminate this excise tax, it'll make that product less expensive and ultimately make our sales in the city here more competitive. The excise tax applies to wholesale marijuana offered by growers in addition to the 15% excise tax imposed by the state of Colorado. It is distinct from the city's 8.75% special sales tax on marijuana purchased by consumers. At the study session that preceded Monday's regular meeting, Gardner suggested the city make up some of the difference by scaling back the work done by city regulators. He mentioned the requirement that dispensaries back up video surveillance footage at an off-site facility as one example of a regulation that creates unnecessary work for the city. "This was really a big rush to overregulate this industry," Gardner said. Jurinski said she believed the city should also operate its recreation centers more like a business, so that the parks, recreation, and open spaces department could become self-sustaining. However, other council members said they believed Gardner and Jurinski hadn't adequately figured out how to fill the gap left by the tax cut, and pointed out that marijuana is still being grown in the city. "We still have 13 licensed cultivation facilities, so I don't think it's deterred anybody from coming to our city," Councilmember Francoise Bergen said. "I have a concern that we would lose revenue by removing this excise tax." Councilmember Allison Combs, too, described Gardner and Jurinski's plans to compensate for the cut as hypothetical, and joined the bipartisan majority of council members who objected to the tax cut moving forward from Monday's study session, meaning it will not be automatically added to an upcoming regular meeting agenda for a vote by the council. The item's sponsors may still choose to bring it forward regardless. "I'm more than happy to make all of my colleagues vote on the record on a tax cut, so I gladly will bring it to the floor," Gardner told the rest of the council. GOP Rep. Ken Buck leaving Congress next week, narrowing GOP slim majority. By Nicholas Riccardi, Associated Press. Colorado Republican Rep. Ken Buck said Tuesday that he'll resign next week, narrowing his party's razor-thin House majority and potentially short-circuiting Representative Lauren Boebert's effort to succeed him. Buck, a staunch conservative who already declined to run for re-election as he became increasingly critical of his party's handling of former President Donald Trump, made his surprise announcement in the midst of the House Judiciary Committee's hearing on Special Counsel Robert Hur's investigation into President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents. During an appearance on CNN, Buck lamented that he hadn't been able to ask a question in the hearing yet, even though he is the third-ranking Republican on the committee. "A lot of this is personal. That's the problem," Buck said. "Instead of having decorum, instead of acting in a professional manner, this place has really devolved into this bickering and nonsense," he said, adding that this was the worst of his 9 years in Congress. Buck's March 22nd departure will reduce the GOP's House majority to only a 5-seat margin and will trigger a special election to serve the remainder of his term. Colorado law requires that it happen in the mid to late June, and Democratic Governor Jared Polis announced Tuesday afternoon that he would set it for June 25th, the same day as the Republican primary to replace Buck in November. Boebert is one of several Republicans running in the primary to replace Buck. She moved across the state to run for Buck's more Republican-friendly seat anchored in Colorado's Eastern Plains. But before the district's voters have their way, a committee of Colorado Republicans must pick a nominee for the special election held the same day as the primary. Political insiders were buzzing Tuesday that that nominee is unlikely to be the controversial Boebert, who had no prior ties to the district and has stirred resentment among Republicans with her maneuvering for the seat. That means there'll be just one Republican nominee on the June 25th special election ballot against whoever the Democrats nominate. The district's many conservative voters will likely be voting for that person to ensure the GOP replaces Buck for the remainder of the year. Then they'll cast ballots for the primary, in which the nominee Republicans just voted for will likely be a candidate along with Boebert. That gives whoever the party committee picks as its nominee a major advantage in the primary contest. Speaking to reporters Tuesday on Capitol Hill, Buck alluded to the ability of the local Republican committee to effectively choose his heir. Whoever fills that seat, both for the next Congress as well as the remainder of this Congress, will do a great job, he said. Buck said that even though he's resigning, he wants to stay involved with politics. "I just feel there is important work to be done concerning the election and how we can choose candidates," Buck added. "So I want to get involved in this election cycle and make sure we choose the best candidate we can." Buck is a former federal prosecutor and district attorney in Northern Colorado who is a member of the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus. Since the 2020 election, however, he's made a name for himself in Washington, breaking with his party on major issues. He voted to certify Biden's presidential win and voted against a Republican push to impeach Biden and against making Representative Jim Jordan a major Trump ally speaker. Cherry Creek Schools Board says it will begin live streaming meetings in April. By Kristen O., Sentinel, Colorado. Reportedly, the only large school district not already live streaming school board meetings, the Cherry Creek School Board, will begin web broadcasting a portion of their regular meetings in April. Board member Ann Egan made the announcement during the board meeting Monday evening. The news comes as Colorado lawmakers prepare to hear a bill that will require local government meetings to be more accessible to the public. A bill introduced to the House Transportation, House and Local Government Committee would force local governments to live stream their meetings and make it more accessible for people with disabilities. The proposed bill was introduced to the House Committee January 31st. However, the hearing of the bill has been rescheduled multiple times. As of Tuesday, the bill is scheduled to be heard at 1:30 p.m. March 20th. Egan said that a portion of the board meetings will be live-streamed. According to district spokesperson Lauren Schnell, the district is still finalizing details and will publish the information later. Snell added that the live-stream details and link will be ready by the next board meeting on April 8th. The meeting will take place at Campus Middle School. The school board unanimously approved all the consent agenda. including a measure allowing Colorado Skies Academy to submit a conversion agreement with Colorado Charter Institute, a statewide charter school authorizer. This means that Colorado Skies Academy may become a CSI charter school beginning next school year. After the conversion, the academy also cannot expand the school within the boundaries of the district. CSI has dozens of charter schools around the state. Krista Coriel, acting director of the charter school, and Dana Kirchmar, board secretary for the charter school, spoke during public comment. They thanked the Cherry Creek board members for allowing them to pursue a conversion agreement with CSI. Previously, at the February board meeting, the board unanimously voted to end the contract with the charter school. They cited declining enrollment rates and financial deficits as reasons for not renewing the contract. The school board also approved changing the boundary lines for Altitude and Woodland Elementary Schools in Southwest Aurora. The board unanimously approved Option A for the boundary changes without any comment at the meeting. However, it was discussed at length during a study session on February 23rd. According to the report that was presented during the study session, Option A was chosen because it was geographically closer to Woodland and because it would affect the least amount of current Altitude students. Two community members spoke against the preferred change, saying that it would be inconvenient to commute to the new elementary school. Aircraft noise and leaded fuel are the targets of a proposed bill winding its way through the legislature. Critics of local airports are hailing legislation that targets noisy flight patterns over homes and schools, and the use of leaded fuel in small aircraft is a step forward toward safer aviation practices. The bill, HB 24-1235, is backed by Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser, who said in a statement that the proposal uses other means other than regulation to get local airports to make their operations safer for their neighbors. Colorado may be unable to regulate flight patterns, but we can use state funds to reward airports that choose to have effective noise plans in place that are approved by the federal government, Weiser said in his statement. Colorado may be unable to mandate that aircraft transition to safer unleaded fuel, but we can create funding incentives to encourage that transition. Colorado can also ensure that communities impacted by flight noise have a voice and a seat on the state board that administers state grants to airports through HB 24-1235, Weiser said. Finance hearing next. The bill is likely to be challenged by airport lobbying groups as unconstitutional, he said. However, the ideas behind the legislation are thoughtful and reflective. And, if necessary, I am prepared to defend this bill in court, Weiser said. After more than 7 hours of testimony Wednesday, the bill passed the state House's Committee on Transportation, Housing, and Local Government and is now headed to the House Finance Committee. A hearing date has not been set yet. The bill creates a state income tax credit for owners of aircraft who transition from using lead fuel to the unleaded variety. Advocates say aircraft powered by leaded fuel leaves a deadly toxic trail over homes and schools. According to the legislation, Colorado State Aviation Grant Program would give grants to general aviation airports and commercial airports to fund infrastructure changes that allow the sale of unleaded aviation gasoline to those airports. The state's aeronautical board would also expand from 7 to 9 voting members by requiring the appointment of 2 members who are residents of communities that are affected by general aviation traffic, the bill states. The bill includes another provision that allows the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment to have a non-voting member on the aeronautical board. Westminster resident Charlene Wiley said via an email that the bill is a good start towards safeguarding homes near local airports. But it also passed with amendments suggested by the aviation industry, she said. In her testimony to the House committee, Wiley said the operations at nearby Rocky Mountain Metropolitan Airport have increased by over 80% since 2017. That traffic is primarily from lead-spewing piston engine aircraft now estimated to dust our homes, schools, and playgrounds with over a ton of lead microparticulates every year, Wiley said. Clearly, the community needs help from this legislature to bring this disregard for public welfare under control, Wiley said. Inglewood accepting applications to fix up neighborhoods. From adorning posts with colorful metal art to creating a sharing box filled with toys, food, and other items, residents are encouraged to submit their ideas to the city to better their neighborhoods. The city is accepting applications for neighborhood improvement grants. Madeline Hinkfuss, the city's neighborhood engagement program manager, said groups can apply for up to $3,000 to complete a project. Projects should activate gathering spaces and bring neighbors together, Hinkfuss said. Projects will celebrate a neighborhood's unique character, engage skills and knowledge from neighborhoods, and aim to improve the quality of life for neighbors. Hinkfuss said the idea for the grant was sparked a few years ago after a Cushing neighborhood leader had a vision to turn an old vacant concrete lot into a gathering space for the neighborhood but needed more assistance than any current neighbor-to-neighbor program could provide. Other neighborhoods also had similar ideas, Hinkfuss said. The grants don't have to be repaid. People can submit various types of projects, including placemaking projects such as murals or sculptures, little free libraries, seed-sharing libraries, community boxes, message boards, new trees, multicultural celebrations, or benches in public spaces. Projects should establish central neighborhood gathering places that connect and help neighbors enhance community resilience by strengthening connections between neighbors. Strengthening connections between neighbors, enhance neighborhood pride, and identify and improve physical condition of a neighborhood, Hinkfuss said. Errors adding up for Medicaid recipients. Colorado Medicaid insurance terminations 7th highest by Eric Galatas. 2/3 of Coloradans who have lost their health insurance during Medicaid's unwinding process are still eligible for coverage, but were terminated due to administrative errors, according to a new Colorado Center on Law and Policy brief. Catherine Wallett, the city's legal director, said she has heard from people who have been forced to postpone critical heart surgery due to lack of coverage, or a child who had cancer treatment who had to stop his treatment for a period of time because the family couldn't afford it, said Wallett. But in fact, he was eligible for Medicaid during the time that he was terminated, so the costs are high. Medicaid coverage renewed automatically during the pandemic, but that policy ended in April or last year. During the first 6 months of unwinding, over 412,000 Coloradans lost coverage. The Colorado Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing has largely dismissed concerns about the high rate of procedural disenrollments, arguing the process has simply returned to normal, and that some participants are not returning paperwork. Wallett said Colorado's enrollment process was broken long before the pandemic. Due to a host of factors, including the state's fragmented county-administrated system, she said Medicaid participants routinely get notices giving them wrong or contradictory information. Many never receive correct notification of their impending termination date. There was an audit done by the legislature, finding 90% of the notices are incorrect, said Wallett. It's really not just the members, it's not just people who should be doing something differently, and that if they just did that, we wouldn't have such a high rate. Arapahoe County deputy fired after conviction for providing gun to felon, by Nina Joss. An Arapaho County Sheriff's Office deputy was fired on March 5th following his conviction by a federal jury for providing a gun to a felon. Johnny Alvarado, 33, was found guilty on March 4th, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Colorado. The jury concluded that Alvarado, a Lakewood resident, had given a firearm and ammunition to his brother-in-law, Kyle Garcia, according to the attorney's office. Garcia was a felon on supervised release at the time. A probation officer found a loaded 9mm semi-automatic firearm in a closet at Garcia's home during a routine visit, according to court documents and officials. During the visit, Garcia allegedly admitted to having the firearm, handling it and raking the slide to see if there was ammunition in the firearm, officials say. Alvarado allegedly admitted to the probation officer that he provided the gun to Garcia knowing he was a felon, officials say. Garcia pleaded guilty to one count of being a felon in possession of a firearm and was sentenced to 66 months of probation, according to officials. Alvarado, who was found guilty of a felony charge of unlawful disposition of a firearm, has not yet been sentenced. He faces up to 15 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000, according to court documents. Alvarado started working in the Arapaho County Detention Facility for the Sheriff's Office on December 30, 2021. According to a press release from the Sheriff's Office. On May 12, 2023, the Sheriff's Office was notified that Alvarado was facing a criminal investigation by the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, Denver Field Division. The Sheriff's Office placed him on paid suspension and opened an internal investigation. Alvarado was arrested days later by the U.S. Marshals Service and was placed on unpaid suspension by the Sheriff's Office at that time. A felony conviction is a disqualifying incident for police officers, according to the Colorado Peace Officer Standards and Training Post Board, which manages certification of police officers across the state. In the past 5 years, 9 officers from the Arapaho County Sheriff's Office have been the subject of action from the Post Board, according to its database. Since January 2019, 8 deputies, including Alvarado, have been fired from the Arapaho County Sheriff's Office, spokesperson Ginger Delgado said. Besides Alvarado, 2 other terminations were after a criminal conviction. How a Littleton Meat Shop is Becoming a Hub for Colorado Businesses by Nina Juss. Stepping into Littleton Meats feels a lot like stepping into a farmer's market. For owner Dave Mayo, that's part of the goal. Just inside the entrance of the small store on West Bowles Avenue, local produce and freshly baked bread sit on racks. Shelves lining the walls are packed with honey, hot sauces, dried pasta, spices, soaps, and more. And in the center, various cuts of fresh meat are visible through a glass case. Before Mayo and his wife bought the shop last year, it was owned and operated by a family-owned processing company called Wheat Ridge Poultry and Meats. When the Mayos took over, they continued the shop's focus on fresh meats, but it evolved into more of a fresh market, Mayo said. We're kind of carrying everything, he said. You pretty much come in and you could get anything you need to make an entire meal. The cuts of steak, chicken, and pork, which still come from Wheat Ridge Poultry and Meats, remain the business core product. But the rest of the shop offers ingredients for culinary imagination. Ground beef could become part of a bolognese sauce made with local tomatoes and poured over pasta. Or a locally made marinade or rub could boost the flavor of a classic steak. Mayo said the shop has cultivated relationships with regulars who return for fresh products and to support Colorado businesses. Mayo said his favorite part of his business is supporting other small local businesses. Before buying Littleton Meats, he regularly sold CBD goods for his other company, 5280 Holistics, at farmers markets, where he befriended other local vendors. Now, about 60 Colorado vendors sell their goods at Littleton Meats, Mayo said. A lot of them are my friends, but a lot of them are brand new, he said. To be able to place a couple of big orders within a couple of months from these people, it's great. It makes me happy to see that they're doing good. Mayo said supporting these businesses helps keep money local, which is good for Colorado's economy. The meat is all natural and fresh, Mayo said. The beef is from Colorado, and the chicken and pork come from Colorado, Iowa, Texas, and Kansas. We focus on the ethical farms, Mayo said. We focus on the natural meat and stuff, so no antibiotics or hormones, preservatives, or anything. For people who do not eat meat, the shop has tofu and will soon start selling a Colorado-made tempeh brand. Mayo said Littleton Meats recently got approved for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. He said he is looking forward to being able to provide healthy, local goods to people with lower incomes. Littleton Meats also has a licensed prep kitchen that small businesses can use to get their food manufacturing license, Mayo said. This helps them be able to expand where they're selling and grow their businesses as well, he said. Mayo said he hopes to have more community events like a farmer's market, Christmas tree sales, pumpkin patches, and more. He also said the shop is starting to collaborate with local restaurants. Littleton Meats will have a corned beef discount for St. Patrick's Day and is planning some sales for March Madness. Littleton envisions Quad Road on South Santa Fe Drive and West Mineral Avenue. Littleton officials say a new roadway layout is needed to reduce traffic congestion at South Santa Fe Drive and West Mineral Avenue. The project will add what's called a quadrant roadway to the intersection. Instead of turning left from Santa Fe Drive onto West Mineral Avenue or vice versa, cars will enter a separate roadway that operates as a path for all left turns. When you have left turns, it takes a lot of the timing away and the efficiency of the intersection, said City Transportation Engineering Manager Aaron Heumann said, adding that left turns require more changes of the traffic signals. So we're taking those left turns and moving them onto this quadrant road instead. Because of the design, the project is sometimes referred to as the Quad Road Project. Heumann said the final design of the project is anticipated to be completed in April. Construction is expected to begin late this year. The intersection is one of the busiest and most congested in the city, he said. Approximately 50,000 cars travel through it on Santa Fe Drive each day, and about 25,000 cars pass through on West Mineral Avenue. At peak traffic hours, vehicles can stack for over a mile and delays can add 15 to 20 minutes to travel time, the project's webpage says. Although traffic still has not returned to pre-pandemic levels, the city expects upwards of 115,000 vehicles to pass through the intersection per day by the year 2040, according to city documents. There's a lot of development still being constructed down south, like Sterling Ranch and other places like that, and Highlands Ranch that are coming up Santa Fe in the future, he said. So if they build more houses down there, it sends more traffic along Santa Fe. We're trying to get ahead of even more congestion that could occur here in the future. The intersection is also a common spot for crashes, Heumann said. The majority of these are likely rear-end crashes resulting from cars hitting each other in moments of high traffic. We had 34 crashes at Santa Fe and Mineral in 2023, he said. That was the most of any intersection in Littleton in 2023. The quadrant design may be unfamiliar to many drivers. as it is the first of its kind in the metro area, Heumann said. The city has put out videos to explain how to use the new roadway. Heumann said there will also be message boards on the roads to alert people of the change when it happens, and road signs will direct people where to go. Path for cyclists. The project also includes a bike path that will go along South Platte River Parkway, which is part of the Quadrant Roadway. The path will be 8 feet away from the roadway, separated by landscaping, and will include lanes for bikes to ride in both directions, Heumann said. There will also be sidewalks and new bus stops on the Quadrant Roadway to accommodate local residents. It's about bicycles, pedestrians, transit use, and vehicles. All of that's being considered as part of this project, he said. The project, including design, will cost about $27 million, according to city documents. Almost half of that cost is being funded by federal dollars through the Colorado Department of Transportation, Heumann said. Littleton is contributing about $5 million. The developers of two upcoming developments in the area are helping fund the project as well. Heumann said the project is currently about $5 million short of funding. He said the shortfall arose from inflation and construction cost increasing since the project started before the pandemic. This missing revenue could come from other project budgets, maintenance budgets, or more grants, he said. For Arapaho County snow crew, Big March Storm arrived well before the first flake fell. As a mid-March winter blast dropped a foot of snow or more in parts of the metro area, most drivers in Arapaho County stayed off the road. But not Dylan Sether. He was happy to be behind the wheel. As one of Arapaho County snowplow drivers, Sether was racking up the miles. During the course of a storm like this, he drives 200 to 250 miles during a 12-hour shift. He's part of a team that works around the clock, striving to keep roads passable, especially for police cars, fire trucks, and ambulances. Sether knows his work has the potential to help save a life. With 23 plows, 5 graders, and 4 loaders, the county's road and bridge division plows 11 designated routes totaling 670 miles in unincorporated Arapaho County. As Sether points out, the plowing operations begin long before the first driver crawls in the seat. He says plowing planning and resourcing can begin as far in advance as 72 hours before a storm's arrival. Road and bridge supervisor Brandon Hutop says it all starts with an imprecise science, meteorology. Hutop said Arapaho contracts with Skyview Weather for meteorological services, including real-time weather updates and modeling. So, before a forecasted storm, a snow patrol can be dispatched across the county to monitor ambient and pavement temperatures. Once the snow begins, Hutop says an evaluation of roadway conditions is also added to the mix. Pavement temperatures are extremely important as they provide crews with a key indicator of whether or not moisture will accumulate on roads. This helps us better plan and properly allocate resources and equipment, he said. Sether, a graduate of Rangeview High School in Aurora, says he takes pride in ensuring his designated route, Route 3, is in the best possible condition. Over his 13-plus years with the county, Sether said that as a plow driver, he's become familiar with the businesses along his route. He knows which businesses open early, which use contract snow removal, where neighboring jurisdictions start and end, and is able, in most cases, to anticipate ways to work with the community he's come to know through the windshield of his truck. Heavy storms tend to find many unprepared motorists stuck in deep snow. Vehicles abandoned on the side of the road create obstacles for plow drivers. In some cases, Hutop says drivers work around the vehicle, But in some instances, an abandoned vehicle in the middle of the road creates a safety hazard. Plow drivers communicate the location of abandoned vehicles to each other and their supervisors. If a vehicle is deemed a safety risk for other motorists, Hutop says the county will seek authorization from the sheriff to use a plow to move it from the road. So if there's one thing that Hutop wishes residents knew, it would be, we're not the Arapahoe County Tow Company. Joking aside, he said, if you don't have to be out on the roads, please stay home. And if you do have to be out, drive with extreme caution and share the road with snow plows. The Colorado Department of Transportation recommends motorists stay 3 to 4 car lengths back from snow plows. And finally, Hutop says don't tailgate a snow plow and never pass one on the right. Colorado Community Media owner purchases printing press, offers lifeline to local news. By Susie Glassman. Colorado Community Media's 24 newspapers will get a much-needed lifeline in the form of a printing press, allowing it to bring printing needs in-house while reducing costs and providing a longer-term solution for other publishers along the Front Range. The National Trust for Local News, which owns Colorado Community Media, purchased the press after raising $900,000 in grant funding toward the project. The donations came through the Colorado Media Project and its coalition of funders, the Bohemian Foundation, Gates Family Foundation, and the Colorado Trust. Amalia Nash, head of transformation for NTLN, said the hope is to start printing CCM's newspapers on the press, located in northeast Denver, by the end of May. By summer, the Trust plans to offer printing services to other newspapers seeking a more affordable solution. The effort to buy the press began after Gannett Publishing Company, which owns the USA Today Network, announced it was closing its plant in Pueblo last August. With few places left to turn, more than 80 Colorado publications that relied on the Pueblo Press, including those at CCM, scrambled to find alternative solutions. We were faced with a decision point and had to figure out where to print instead, Nash said. So we started seeking bids and trying to figure out how we were going to continue to provide print products that people want. CCM wasn't alone. The Colorado Media Project, a nonpartisan philanthropic initiative dedicated to supporting and sustaining local news, surveyed publishers impacted by the Gannett Press closure and found that one publication was forced to close. Several others were wrestling with whether to go digital only, and at least three publishers of multiple papers opted to consolidate titles. In October, the Colorado Sun reported that the findings of a working group on the future of printing in Colorado, published by the Colorado Press Association, Colorado News Collaborative, and the Colorado Media Project, underscored the blow of the Pueblo closure and highlighted the nearly exhaustive printing capacity statewide and unsustainable cost increases. The report voices concern that continuing those trajectories could lead to the demise of a sizable number of publications. Nash said CCM ultimately chose to contract with the Denver Post for printing, but did not consider it a long-term solution. Since the National Trust for Local News purchased Colorado Community Media in 2021, our printing costs have gone up 60%. Which was obviously very significant for an operation of this size, said Nash, adding that, we started having discussions around these larger commercial printers closing and the fact that there weren't very many options in the Front Range. So we asked, what if we came up with an option? What would that look like? NTLN began researching, talking to funding partners, and putting together a plan to buy a press. It's heartening to think that we have an opportunity that helps us regulate our press cost better and that we have a real opportunity to help the media ecosystem in that way, CCM publisher Linda Shapley said. While the print newspaper and magazine market has steadily declined since the mid-2000s, it's still projected to earn $123.5 billion in the U.S. this year. Many communities still lack reliable internet access, and some people continue to prefer printed news, according to Nash. And getting a paper copy to commemorate an event is still meaningful for many. Recently, parents whose children were featured in a bilingual newsletter dedicated to Commerce City reached out to Shapley, asking if there were printed copies available. "You can show the story on your phone or a computer, but it's just not the same," she said. At the same time, CCM has focused on its digital transformation, relaunching its websites last fall and introducing new newsletters. Shapley said it's important to give people news in all the formats they want it. "As much as people talk about how print is going away, the fact of the matter is that it's still here, and it needs support," Shapley said. As outdoor pickleball gets underway in Colorado, How to Avoid Injuries by Nina Joss. As the weather gets warmer and spring comes alive, so do the sounds of plunking and foot shuffling. Pickleball players are emerging from indoor gyms, or perhaps shaking off their hibernations, and ready to hit outdoor courts across Colorado. Pickleball has soared in popularity across the country, increasing by 85.7% from 2021 to 2022, reaching millions of participants, according to the most recent data available from the Sports and Fitness Industry Association. The paddle sport combines elements of tennis, badminton, and table tennis. It has a reputation for attracting aging recreationists, but the average age in 2022, while old compared to professional athletes, was just 35, according to the association. And, as with any sport, too much activity, improper form, and a lack of physical care can lead to injuries. Dr. Anthony Sanchez, an orthopedic surgeon at Advent Health Medical Group Orthopedics at Castle Rock, said pickleball-related injuries in his office have approximately doubled in the past year. 12 to 18 months ago, I would probably see one, maybe two, pickleball-related injuries a week," he said. Fast forward to present day, now it's about 3 to 4 people a week. Pickleball is a low-impact sport that can be easier on joints than other sports that involve more running and jumping, Sanchez said. It also gives players a reason to go outside, exposing them to vitamin D through the sun, while offering healthy camaraderie, which has positive psychological benefits. But if other doctors are seeing the same trend as Sanchez, it means pickleball players also need to take precautions when playing so that the harms do not outweigh the benefits. The majority of the pickleball injured patients that Sanchez sees are aging athletes. "The most common pickleball-related injury among patients is ankle sprains," Sanchez said. He also sees a lot of shoulder and elbow overuse issues, as well as lower back problems, hamstring strains, and some Achilles tendonitis, or inflammation of the tendon. "Some patients complain of pickleball elbow," he said, "which is the same as tennis elbow." A few patients have suffered from shoulder bursitis, which is related to the inflammation of fluid-filled sacs that pad and cushion the shoulder. Some of these patients frequently come to Sanchez for cortisone injections before big tournaments to help reduce pain and swelling, he said. "It was getting pretty serious," he said. Since players love the sport so much, he said they may end up playing more than they probably should and overusing their muscles and tendons. "What I understand from my patients is they thoroughly enjoy the sport," he said. "It gives them a lot of pleasure and happiness. They love the camaraderie and they end up playing multiple games. I don't think pickleball itself is an injury-causing sport, as it is more that patients are basically just really enjoying the sport and playing it more often. Sanchez does not want his patients to stop playing pickleball. Instead, he offered advice on how they can stay safe while playing. How to take precautions. To prevent injuries that come from overuse, Sanchez said stretching is important. He recommends stretching before and after play, specifically focusing on lower back and hamstring stretching. He also recommends that patients limit the number of hours they play so they don't push themselves too hard, which can cause injury. To protect their ankles, players should know the court, ensuring it's dry and there are no obstructions. Sanchez said wearing proper, supportive footwear can also help prevent ankle sprains and Achilles tendon injuries. For people who play doubles, Sanchez said it's important for partners to communicate with each other to prevent collisions. And for older players, he recommends avoiding backpedaling since it can lead to falls and potential fractures. Sanchez said pickleball has been life-changing for some of his patients, and he wants them to stay safe so they can keep doing it. Pickleball is a sport that's changed a lot of these athletes, not only physically, but mentally, he said. It keeps them very active in a very active community. They develop relationships with other teammates. It brings back that competitive spirit that helps keep them young. Outdoor pickleball courts around the metro area. Outdoor pickle courts are available at Clement Park in Jefferson County, Cornerstone Park in Inglewood, Coyote Ridge Park in Castle Pines, Lone Tree Recreation Center in Lone Tree, Amherst Park in Westminster, Wood Glen Pickleball Courts in Thornton, Charles Whitlock Recreation Center in Lakewood, Skyland Park in Denver. Press release. Denver Seminary announces presidential retirement and appointment of search committee. By sponsored content. The Board of Trustees of Denver Seminary, at their March 7 meeting, received and accepted the request from Dr. Mark Young to complete his 15-year tenure as president effective December 31, 2024. Dr. Young will assume the position of chancellor on January 1, 2025. Serving alongside the faculty, staff, and trustees at Denver Seminary these past 15 years has been the capstone to a 43-year calling as a theological educator, said Dr. Young. Priscilla and I are honored to have been a part of this community. Notable highlights of Dr. Young's tenure include the creation of a new mission and vision statement, along with a fresh articulation of the seminary's core commitments, which continue to serve as guiding principles for the institution. In addition, the seminary launched a strategic initiative to make every degree program accessible fully online and fully in person. Under his leadership, the seminary's endowment experienced unprecedented growth that facilitated the creation of a more sustainable financial model for the seminary moving into the future. Dr. Young has been instrumental in equipping the institution to fulfill its mission on local, national, and global scales, leaving an indelible mark on our students, alumni, faculty, staff, and the wider community, said Board of Trustees Chair Alisa Morgan. We are grateful for the passionate and strategic leadership of Dr. Young. Because of his commitment, we are prepared for this next stage in the seminary's history as we transition our mission to the next generation of leadership. Dr. Young championed several major initiatives, such as the School Counseling Mental Health Initiative, to address the mental health crisis in schools, the Pathways for Tomorrow Initiative to help meet the needs of Black and Hispanic communities of faith, and the Gospel Initiative to provide resources for the believing community to create a more credible, compelling, and compassionate presence of the gospel while engaging divisive social and cultural issues facing the church today. The Board of Trustees has appointed a search committee representative of key constituencies to facilitate the board in finding and appointing the seminary's next president. Board of Trustee member David Hazelton will serve as the chair. As Denver Seminary looks to the future, the Board of Trustees has engaged Job Fit Matters, a nationally recognized firm specializing in recruiting leaders for Christian higher education, to initiate the presidential search process. Over the next few weeks, Job Fit Matters will be on a listening tour, pickup. Job Fit Matters will be on a listening tour, meeting with faculty, staff, students, alumni, and other key constituents to discuss the search process, solicit recommendations on candidates, and gather information on essential qualities, skills, and experiences desired in the next president. Denver Seminary is a non-denominational graduate school of theology founded in 1950 and located in Littleton, Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.